Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome. This is episode 131 of the Robots Podcast. I am Jana, and today we will be hearing from researchers at EPFL in Switzerland about a new artificial compound eye. But first, as always, let's have a listen to the latest news and developments in robotics with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Last week, the world's largest do-it-yourself festival, San Mateo's annual Maker Faire, brought together 165,000 visitors and countless exhibitors and participants ranging from hobbyists and performers to startups to research groups, hackerspaces and supporting companies. Robots were very well represented. We particularly liked the official Arduino robot, an open everything two-wheeled robot with built-in compass, 5 bottom-facing IR sensors, push buttons and potentiometers for input, and a speaker and LCD screen for output, which can be yours for $275. We also like the modular, very hackable and Arduino-compatible LinkBot, which makes it easy to snap together your own mobile robot gripper, and the increasingly impressive lineup of bartending robots. The Maker Faire also featured a drone games arena in the expo hall, with more drones, blimps, satellites, and rockets, making space a clear trend throughout the entire event. The possibly largest robot density was found in arts and education, with flaming, fighting, shaking, swimming, walking, and talking robots, including the Flaming Lotus Girl, Makey Me, Ruminate, Goldieblocks, Light Up, Hacker Scouts, Arcbotics, Timio, EZ Robot, and Barobo, along with many others. Finally, the appearance of portable CNC machines, like ShopBot's HandyBot, or Other Labs' OtherMill, as well as new 3D printers, like the OmNom Project or PrinterBots, highlighted the trend towards more and more small, affordable tools for makers. Looks like the maker revolution is far from over. It's just getting started. For ample photographic and video evidence of the event, have a look at robohub.org.
The Curved Artificial Compound Eye Project, or CURVIS project for short, was funded under the 7 Framework Program. It is a research initiative that aims to design, develop, and assess artificial compound eyes, which will offer many advantages over conventional cameras. Ramon Perissat is a postdoctoral researcher, and Mikhail Dobrosinski is a doctoral assistant at EPFL in Switzerland. Both are working on the CURVIS project and spoke to us about their latest research, which is due to be published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Hi Ramon, hi Michał, welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hello, thank you.
Congratulations on your PNAS paper. I know it's been a long time in the making. Can you tell us what an artificial compound eye is?
Well, an artificial compound eye is a kind of a vision sensor, which is actually inspired in the eyes of insects. And as main characteristics of these eyes is actually they have a panoramic field of view, also a very high temporal resolution to the cost of low spatial resolution, compared especially to those eyes of a mammal, for example, or vertebrates.
What does it look like?
Basically, the structure of a compound is pretty different to the one of a mammal or a human eye. In case of compound eyes, they are composed of optical units, very small optical units arranged on a matrix. They're called ommatidia. And every one of these ommatidia is actually, they have a lens, a microlens, which focuses light on directly on some photoreceptors, and all of them are actually surrounding the head of an insect. It's pretty different to the human eye, for example, that we have a pretty bigger lens, and actually all the light is going through this lens to a set of photoreceptors at the back of the eye.
How big is the prototype?
So our prototype is about 2 cubic centimeters, And actually we have about 600 omatidia in this prototype to have a resolution, angular resolution, we speak in this case, of 4 degrees. And this actually, these omatidia are arranged on a semi-cylindrical surface. So basically this provides actually with a field of view of about 180 degrees in one of the directions and 60 degrees in the vertical direction.
What's an omatidia?
So an omatidia is actually the units, every one of the units of an insect eye. Every omatidium consists of one lens, a set of photoreceptors, and actually we have light passing through this lens directly only on these photoreceptors. We don't have this kind of omnidirectional view of a mammal eye, so every omatidia is looking at a specific part, section of the field of view of the insect eye.
Why take inspiration from the fly?
Basically, this comes a little bit from the expertise of the lab. We are experts in flying robotics, and basically, if you see around in nature, about the most expert flyers are, we could say, actually the insects or the birds. In the case of the insects, it's because they're actually aiming at having some smaller and smaller and lighter platforms, and if you have to find inspiration of a good flyer with a lower with low resources, actually, the insects provide as much of the solutions we can find in nature.
Yeah, I think what's very important is that insects have very small brain, and basically the whole image processing with such a camera has to be simple. And what insects do, they achieve very sophisticated behavior. They can do following corridor, or they can do obstacle avoidance, still having this very simple brain. And this was also the aim for building the camera like that, that we could post-process the image in a very simple way.
How would you say this camera is different from just a regular camera you would buy for your computer, for example? We understand now that the mammal eyes are different from the fly eyes. Is it something similar for the hardware, for the cameras?
Well, it is. The whole principle behind is different, because how mammals see is we perceive images directly, and we have very dense resolution images with the nice colors and the whole wavelength of the visible light. What insects do, they, instead of perceiving images, they rather focus on extracting motion from the environment. And through perceiving motion directly, they are trying to extract cues for navigation. And therefore, they don't need this very high spatial resolution camera. But instead, they would rather prefer having something more of a high temporal resolution to get all these cues much faster, even though they are not so precise.
So I guess they use optic flow, right, to be able to process this. Can you maybe explain it in a couple words for the people who wouldn't know that?
Yes, actually optic flow is, let's say, for a camera or for an eye, is the pattern of motion that we observe. A good example is actually when we are driving in the motorway, and actually if we look to the objects which are closer to us, to our car, they actually move very fast. However, those mountains which are really far from our car and on the sides, they actually move very slowly, or even we don't see any motion. Identically, if we look at the front of our car, we don't see any motion, because actually what we have is a kind of an expansion of motion around a point. However, if we look at the size of our car, this motion is very high. With this optic flow, we can actually extract a lot of information about the environment that we can use actually for our flight, for our navigation, for example, to stabilize the flight.
But you should know that optic flow reflects this relative speed, so it does not give you information directly about the distance to the objects or about your speed. It's always very relative. So if you have many moving objects in your field of view, you will get always the perception of how your speed depends on others or other objects in general. So it contains more information than just a very simple distances, for example.
How do you think you could use this information in a concrete application?
So insects use this information, and we think that we can reproduce the same behavior with robots as insects do. So it's already been shown with other cameras and other systems that you can do very efficient collision avoidance. You can detect objects and you can try to avoid them. It's been also shown that you can do corridor following. You can follow, for example, wall. You can navigate with this manner. You can do localization. You can do odometry, meaning you can find your position with respect to the previous positions you had. And as such, you can also build kind of a map of the environment. I think that ants do that, right? Through the optic flow. It's called, they integrate the path through, they integrate the optic flow to get the path of their motion, and based on that, they also know what is their current position with respect to the position of the nest, for instance. And all that you can do, all of that you can do with robots.
Right, and the burden is on the hardware of the sensor rather than on some complex processing behind the scene. I've seen optic flow sensors that are flat that have been put on robots, for example. Why make something that's curved?
That's a very good question. I come back to the example of the motorway. If we have a flat sensor, we were able to see actually optic flow in only one direction. However, think for example that if we're actually moving in a motorway, if we look in the front, we can actually identify the direction at which we are moving, for example, because we have this expansion of optic flow. If we go to the sides of the car, we can actually see very fast optic flow. This is very useful. If we can actually extract all this information with a single sensor, that's much more efficient than having a few of these sensors placed all around the robot or whatever platform you're using.
Why is it challenging to build such a system?
Basically, the challenging part is actually attaining this panoramic field of view. Basically, to get this, we need to have a curved sensor in some way. So far, many people try to have curved optics, which is a lot of people managed to do. However, they couple this with a planar photosensitive device. This actually brings distortion, this brings a misalignment between the elements. That's actually not really good for the, because you need a post-processing of the image. Some few people are doing research about the flexible electronics, that you could actually curve these electronics and try to couple them with the optics, but that's again very challenging. And actually we found an assembly method where you can actually get really good alignment between these optics and the photosensors. We have to remember that these omatidia, these elements, are looking at one direction in the field of view, and this is very important that for your image extraction, that you are sure that the light that you're obtaining is actually coming from this specific section of the field of view.
Can you tell us a bit more about how you make them and what the different layers of this sensor are?
Yes, we can actually compare our artificial omatidia in our sensor with the natural omatidia of animals. They have actually a layer with lenses, let's say. We actually created also an array of micro lenses. Underneath, we actually place an array of photo detectors, similarly to the eyes of insects. And then underneath, we have another layer, which is kind of the mechanical support and electrical connection between all the omatidia. All these three layers make only 1 millimeter of thickness. And that's what we do actually through the fabrication process, through some pre-designed dicing. We are able to bend these three layers, providing them with all the field of view that we need for the prototype.
I can add something. This also gives another possibility, because we bend the sensor. So at first, when the sensor is not attached to anything, the sensor is actually flexible. It gives you actually a flexible camera.
So you can attach it on other surfaces and hopefully have it work in that manner.
You can attach it to nearly whatever you want, in whatever shape you want.
Is there a reason to fix it then?
There is. There is a reason to fix it, because there is something like an optimal configuration that is defined by the optics that you're using. So if your lens has if your omatidium has a particular field of view, you want to bend the whole stack, the whole imager, so that you have these fields of view of consecutive omatidia aligned.
That also have fields that overlap slightly, or?
You can overlap them slightly, but this would be mostly to prevent having gaps in your field of view. That's very unwanted. Mm-hmm. But ideally, you would like to have them very nicely aligned in being in parallel.
So you guys have built this amazing sensor. What are its characteristics?
Basically, the characteristics we obtain at the end, we try to compare them very much to the eyes of Drosophila, actually. In terms of angular resolution, we have a very similar angular resolution. Also, the field of view is pretty similar, so we have about 180 degrees of field of view. On the other hand, of course, we're not. It's still very challenging to get to the size of the insect eyes, because there's not enough technology to actually reach that. But on the other hand, we have an eye which you can actually say you're seeing something really similar to what Drosophila would see of the outer world.
Yeah, we had this discussion actually when we were comparing the Drosophila eye to our sensor, and we said that it is like 10 times bigger than the Drosophila eye in terms of volume.
Approximately.
And then we had the same number of omatidia for around 600 material, right?
Yes. So yeah, we have basically the same angular resolution.
How do you process the information from the device to go from the sensor to actually having an optic flow sensor?
That's also a very good question, because actually it gives me the opportunity to mention one of the main advantages of our sensor. Our sensor is self-contained. We actually, as I mentioned before, we have our imager, which is about 1 millimeter thick. If we bend it, we actually have empty space inside the concavity of this surface. And basically what we do is actually to profit from this void, and we put all the electronics that we need in our prototype in order to have all the readout of the data, and also we can have processing of the data in such a way that we can have a fully functional prototype, but we can actually plug and play it on any robot or platform we have.
Actually, our sensor can work as a brain for the robot, because we have we incorporated two microcontrollers that give us the opportunity to do the whole image processing directly on board. We have the inertial measurement unit that allows us to decouple the rotational from the translational components of the optic flow. It's very important also. And we also have a lot of spare computational power that one can use to do additional algorithm, let's say, on the board that is on the top layer of the optic flow and works with the optic flow, for example, drive the robot.
This is a rather big European project. Who else is working on this with you?
Well, this is a very very nice project. We're actually joining the forces or the expertise from four different labs: University of Tübingen in Germany, Fraunhofer Institute of Applied Optics in Jena, University of Marseille in France, and ourselves, CPFL in Switzerland.
I was going to ask you to describe the experiments you did, but actually you have a demo that's running here, so maybe we can just have a look and you can describe what these experiments look like. So what you have here is your sensor, which, as you said before, is pretty tiny, and you have it plugged into your computer, and that's going to send the signal of the optic flow to the software program that you've designed to be able to see what the sensor sees, basically. Can you tell us a bit more about what we're looking at now?
So basically what we have is basically the image that we extract with the sensor. At the moment that I hold my the sensor still, so basically we have a completely gray image. As soon as we have something moving around the sensor, we're going to have the contrast of this pattern of whatever object we're moving in front.
And it's really awesome, because here you're moving your hand in front of the sensor, and we can actually see your hand, which increases in contrast as it is moving in front of the sensor. And you can see a little vector where your hand's moving to tell us basically the motion of that hand in front of the sensor. So you do get that information of motion of the things that are around it.
Exactly. We have to think, of course, that this is on some visualization for demonstration, but at the end, our sensor is not going to extract image and show it somehow, but at the end, what we want to do with our sensor is to plug it into a robot, and this visual information is used directly by the robot to react to whatever event is happening. For example, if there's an object approaching from one side, it's going to see the motion of this object relative to the movement of the robot, and it's going to, for example, try to avoid it by directing the robot to an opposite direction.
And I saw you try it in the dark before. Why does it work?
Exactly. So actually, this is the reason is that our photo detectors, they have a wide dynamic range. It can work for sure in some sunny day, but also down to about full moon and even less than full moon illumination. So one of the also interesting characteristics, actually, we have some implemented neuromorphic circuits beside the photo detectors of the Omatidia. And these photo detectors are due to this neuromorphic engineering. They are adaptive to light, basically, and we can adapt to the illumination of the environment, and the motion pattern of basically the contrast we observe is completely independent or very much not much dependent on the illumination of the room.
What it actually gives you is kind of a background removing. So if you don't have any background in your image, this provides this feature that you only focus on the contrast. So, and the contrast is independent on the illumination.
So you guys mentioned plug and play a lot. It looks like you could just strap this on a robot, right? What would it take, and have you done this already?
Well, it would take a few screws and a cable.
And basically, I think the point is we made this device. As I said, we have all the electronics components available. We have microcontrollers, which actually the user can program for the application you have in mind. So basically what you need is actually to find the proper mechanical attachment to your robot, and also, of course, design the communication from the sensor to the robot, and also maybe program the kind of control you can have, the kind of application you want to have. Otherwise than that, then it's up to the user and his imagination to just think about the application.
And what are the next steps for you?
So the next steps, actually, since we are a lab with a lot of expertise on robots and robotics and also flying robotics, the idea is actually to implement our sensor on robots and have flying robots being steered by our sensor and be able, for example, to have a very highly autonomous small quadrotors being steered and navigating only with the visual information provided by our sensor.
All right. Thanks, Hamon. Thanks, Miha, for being here with us on Robots.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. As usual, you can find extra information about this project on our website at robotspodcast.com, where you can also access all our past episodes. The next podcast will air in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Eyes with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.